Well, good Wednesday afternoon, everyone. Hi, I'm Rob Snow. So great to be with you today. We have three candidates on the afternoon edition today in the upcoming municipal election. Two candidates from Bay Ward and one from Cumberland Ward. We'll be talking about a number of issues, including campaign financing and how to save money at Ottawa City Hall by leveraging more efficient technologies. So that's coming up a little later in our program. It's time for the Wednesday House Call, and Dr. Barry Dworkin is back with us in the Hal Anthony studio. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
Ready to take your health-related phone calls, and the phone lines are open right now at 521-TALK, 521-8255. Star 580 is a free phone call if you're on the Bell Mobility System, and a free long-distance call as well. It's 1-800-580-CFRA. Encourage you to call early because the phone lines do get quite filled a little later in the hour. Now, in health news, one of the big stories today, Dr. Dworkin, is a word that at least one Canadian has been infected by a new superbug that defies treatment, could spread rapidly around the world, including, according to a leading Canadian microbiologist. And it's called antibiotic resistance NDM-1. What do you know about this?
This is a bacterium that NDM-1 stands for New Delhi metallo-beta-lactamase. That's the fancy term.
Okay.
Comes from India, where the bacteria was discovered. This is an enzyme that breaks down an antibiotic that is used to treat very resistant strains of bacteria. This antibiotic is called carbapenems. It's the group. It's called carbapenems. It's a relative of penicillins, but the molecular structure has been varied to such a degree that it works a bit differently. And this is the first type of enzyme that has been seen in a bacteria to protect the bacteria from this antibiotic. Problem with this is that this enzyme is produced by a gene in the bacteria. The bacteria have DNA.
I see.
It codes for this enzyme, which is a protein,
okay. And
acts as a protective mechanism. But it's transferring this gene to other bacterial strains. In fact, what they have discovered is there's a gentleman in the UK that went to India, came back home, found to have these bacteria in his gut, E. coli, Klebsiella, very common bacteria,
mm-hmm. That
contained this enzyme as well. Although he wasn't sick at the time, these were resistant microbes. So the concern is because this transfers and seems to transfer so readily from not just one bacteria, one type of bacteria, but to many different types of bacteria, that the spread is not just one disease process or one bacterium that goes around and infects people, but rather can spread to a whole host of other common pathogens or microbes that cause urinary tract infections, pneumonias, skin infections, and such.
The people, for the most part, that have been infected by this have gone to India. They say the problem is what they call medical tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll need you to comment on this, but it seems as though people from the United States and Canada who've been infected, is that even the proper term, infected with this bacteria? They've gone there to get cheaper elective surgery because obviously it's less expensive in India to have cosmetic surgery, but not just that. If they're suffering from heart disease and want to get that treated, if they've been in a traffic accident and want to get that treated, burns, cosmetic surgery, what have you. They've gone to India, they've been admitted to a hospital in India, and it's only when they return to Canada or the United States that they find out they're sick, right?
Right.
Right.
But
what do you make of that phenomena?
Well, this is not exclusive to India, though.
Okay.
Because there are people, for example, that live in Scandinavian countries, and they go to Britain for their surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
And they're assumed to have, when they return back home, they're assumed to have MRSA-resistant methicillin-resistant Staph aureus when they come by default, if they're in a British hospital, by default. So it's not just India. It's any country you go to, there's usually some endemic or some pathogen that has some resistance, and you can pick that up. And it's not just the tourism. I mean, let's face it, there are other diseases, ancient diseases, that transferred before you had mass migrations. Syphilis is one. Other sexually transmitted diseases that traveled the globe. TB went all over the place. So it's not just the fact that you're traveling. This is what bugs do. And so the only way you can really combat this at this juncture where there are no antibiotics to treat this. And that being said, there aren't a lot of people presenting with this infection now.
But the warning is being issued.
The warning is being
especially
issued.
Especially in a commentary in The Lancet.
That's right.
This could become a global medical crisis.
That is correct. They're not mincing words about it. They're saying that this could be the nightmare scenario with regards to resistance. So we have to look and see what happens. They're projecting and predicting is fraught with error. So they're bringing attention to people to say, look, we found this bug. It does transfer to other microbes.
Right.
And the only way in hospitals, for example, where you see this is you have to institute proper infection control. So isolating patients, washing your hands, really preventing patient-to-patient transfer.
What happens to these people who have this bug?
Well, that's...
Do they die?
That's the issue. If you can't treat them and they're not responding to these antibiotics...
Can it run its course? Is it potentially fatal?
That's the concern, is that it can be potentially fatal. And so they're not really reporting on what has happened to the people who have had these infections. They're just simply saying that they were infected.
Right.
But if you have a microbe that is causing a severe infection, lung infection, intestinal infection, what have you, and you can't treat it, that bacteria is going to continue to reproduce and eventually destroy the host. So that is the main concern.
That's scary stuff.
This is what happens with bacteria. They adapt. They adapt faster than our ability to produce antibiotics to hold them in check. And because they so freely combine and interchange their DNA amongst each other, they develop very quickly resistances to the antibiotics that we use against them. So really, you're always playing catch up. So right now, what you have only available is to minimize the chance of these microbes interacting, making sure in a hospital setting that you have minimized transfer. That's what you have to do. You don't have any other option.
Okay. Boy, oh boy. What a way to start the program.
Yeah, pretty
heavy-duty stuff.
No kidding.
Dr. Barry Dworkin here for the Wednesday House Call, and we'll get to the phone calls next. Question about vertigo, question about food allergies as well. 521-TALK, *580 or 1-800-580-CFRA. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday House Call. 521-TALK, *580 or 1-800-580-CFRA. Leo, thanks for waiting. Go ahead, Leo. You're on.
Yes, doctor. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
We spoke about a year ago about painful sex.
Mm-hmm.
And you suggested at that time that I go for an MIR.
Right.
And I finally convinced my urologist.
Mm-hmm.
And I went for it in June.
Right.
And the report came back and he said everything was all right.
Okay.
What do I do now?
Well, it's a good question. The thing is, you're still having pain, though. Did they have any explanation for you as to what they thought might be causing the difficulty?
Not at all.
Well, I mean, I'm at a disadvantage here, Leo, because I don't have any medical information in detail about you. But, from what I remember what you were talking about, we were wondering whether it was the prostate or something along those lines that was causing pain.
Yeah, I had two TURPs.
Yeah.
And 27 months apart.
Yeah, and you can have, as a result of the surgery, you can have damage that does lead to pain. And unfortunately, the pain can be on a more permanent basis. That is one of the side effects of removing parts of the prostate gland.
I had this problem before I went for the first TURP.
Right, but having a TURP, though, can make things a lot worse. That's what I'm saying.
Is that right?
Yeah, usually what is reported when you have these kind of surgeries is it can damage nerves, it can damage how things function, and it can lead to increased pain. Now, granted that you had pain prior to that, but I unfortunately can't give you much more of an answer at this point as to why I think that you're having this pain. Obviously, it's located in one specific area. And what I would say is that, although the MRI was normal, all that's telling us is that anatomically the tissues are not enlarged. But that doesn't mean that there isn't any nerve damage or something that really is not picked up by the MRI, and in which case there are some other ways to try to figure out whether the pain is within the urinary tract. They can even inject in through the bladder, into the bladder, some anesthetic to try and numb the area to see if that indeed relieves some of the pain, at least to try and isolate where this pain is coming from. But unfortunately, I just don't have enough information to give to Leo to tell him what to do next.
Okay, let's go to Lucy on line one. Lucy.
Yes, good afternoon, doctor.
Good afternoon.
I've been diagnosed about 3 months ago with vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really the high-end one. It's pretty well a very light one.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor told me, he said, you have to be patient, it will go on its own.
Right.
And 2 months later, I went to see him, and it started to really get a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But I had about 2 days that I was free of it, and then it started again. And now it's been going on for another month. So I have the vertigo for about 3 months.
They're not very comfortable having that.
No, they're not very comfortable. And I just don't know. Like whenever I get up in the morning, my head feels so big, you know.
And when you move your head in a particular direction, does it make you feel like the room is spinning or that you're...
No, at first, whenever it was diagnosed, yeah, the room was spinning
right.
a bit. Not much, but it's not spinning that much anymore. It's just kind of, I feel like I'm lightheaded.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm starting to wonder, is that ever going to go away on its own? Or he prescribed some SIRS.
CERC, yes,
beta-histine. Yeah, and he said, I don't think it's going to really help you in your case. And I tried it, and it's true. Mm-hmm. Didn't do anything for me.
Well, when you mentioned vertigo means that, you know, when you move your head, it really feels like you're on a roller coaster.
Oh.
So if that's not the sensation that you're having, it may not necessarily be vertigo anymore. Because vertigo really does mean, you know, you feel off balance. When you move, you feel you may fall over. That's what usually you see with that. Is that what you originally had? Is that the type of symptoms you had at first?
Well, at first, yeah, I felt dizzy, mm-hmm. and I was, I was off balance a bit. And whenever I went to see my doctor, and I have a very good doctor, I don't have any problem with that.
Right.
And I kind of thought that's what it was because I talked to so many people that mm-hmm. had it. And then it got to be really, really light. But the thing is, sometimes you get up in the morning. Morning, like most of the morning is bad. Like the only time that I have peace is whenever I lay down for a while or I stay mm-hmm. sit still. I can still function. It's not because I cannot function. I can drive. But there was a week, last week, I had a whole week that I started to have nausea.
Right.
And I had to take Gravol, and I spend most of my time in bed because I sure didn't want to go anywhere.
Okay. Well, there is a condition. The most common cause, one of the more common causes of vertigo is something called benign positional vertigo. And this is when you have the balance organs, one of the balance organs gets obstructed or blocked, and so it doesn't send the signals to the brain that the brain is expecting when you move. And so the brain gets confused with that, and you end up feeling nauseated and dizzy. That usually does resolve over time. It can take weeks, if sometimes months, but there are also, and neurologists are really good at doing this, if they make a diagnosis of benign positional vertigo, there's sometimes a tiny little crystal that's in the balance organ that sort of floats around and blocks the balance organ from working properly, and they have a series of maneuvers they have when they turn the head and position the body a certain way to dislodge the crystal and sometimes eliminate that feeling of vertigo and dizziness and nausea pretty quickly. So
mm-hmm.
what I would suggest is if this is continuing and still persists and you're still getting nauseated and feeling uncomfortable, the next step would likely be to see a neurologist who has the expertise in doing this particular maneuver. There's a couple of maneuvers that are done. And also to make a formal diagnosis of what they think is causing this condition. So I wouldn't just sit on this if it's going on 3 months and it's still there. I probably would want to see a neurologist just to get confirmation. If it is this, then at least you know that it will resolve. And if it isn't, well, then there's probably other things that need to be done to evaluate it.
I see. Okay. Well, that's a good thing. I should do that then.
I would suggest that's been 3 months. I probably would, given that, you know, you're still feeling uncomfortable.
We'll pick it up after the news. More of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin after the 3:30 news on 580 CFRA. Again, Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for the Wednesday House Call. And right back to the phone lines. Number of people who are waiting quite some time. Question about allergies from JC. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Doctor, I threw away my bottle of vitamins, and I've started juicing besides the regular fruit and veggies that I eat. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, am I at risk of developing food allergies, for instance, if I juice carrots every day?
No, there's no reason to believe that that would happen. Usually food allergies start earlier in life. You tend to see that during childhood. And most common ones being, you know, peanut allergies being one. But it's not something that if you consume a lot of a particular food that you will develop an allergy to it. I think that's great if you're using real food and preparing stuff at home and consuming that. That's fantastic. You know, I mean, there's certainly nothing in that to contribute to any development of allergies. So, no, you're not going to develop any reaction to the carrots or any other vegetable that you're going to use. If you're eating the real vegetables before you puree them or juice them and you're not reacting to them, it's extremely unlikely that you're going to end up reacting to it by juicing them.
Ah, good news. Well, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for waiting, JC. Let's go to Colette. Says hard to breathe when it's humid. Colette.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I've been finding this summer extremely difficult with the heat and the humidity.
Mm-hmm.
I do have heart disease, but I've just had my blood work done and my cholesterol is fine. There's mm-hmm. nothing wrong. But I find that when I'm outside, I find it difficult to breathe. It's like my chest is swelling, mm-hmm. like I have a pressure and has... It's not at all like the other type of pressure that I felt when I had to go in to the Heart Institute. You know, my left arm was numb, my jaw was hurting, my teeth were hurting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all that kind of pain at all. It just feels like I have a hard time breathing.
Okay.
And I don't understand. I know I am allergic to mold also, so mm-hmm. that make...
Well, in hot and humid weather, especially for people who have had a history of heart disease or lung disease... It does become more difficult to breathe. The lungs can, as you mentioned, your lungs can get inflamed. They can, the airways themselves, the tubes that carry the air down into the lungs, can swell a little bit because of the heat and humidity. They narrow, and because they narrow, it becomes much more difficult to breathe. There's more air resistance as you try to breathe in and out. And that's one of the caveats and one of the warnings that are given to people, especially on very hot and humid days, who may have heart disease or lung disease, that going outside in hot, humid weather when we had 35, 40 degree type humidexes, that is extremely taxing on people who have chronic diseases. And so that, and essentially that is why that is happening. When you're not going to have the same thing on nice, cool days, it tends to be a lot easier on your lungs, a lot easier to breathe, but hot, humid weather is definitely difficult for most people that are out there. It can be very difficult after a while.
Is there anything she can do to make it easier?
Well, you can't stop the hot, humid weather outside.
Right.
So,
it's a puffer or something like that.
Sometimes, yeah. But I would be more concerned that that it's the environment itself around you that's doing that, and so it's more trying to avoid that during especially times of the day where it's extremely hot. So being in more of an air-conditioned environment as opposed to venturing out, I know that might be a bit restrictive, but it's certainly better to keep that under control that way than even if you're using a puffer, you're still in an environment that's exacerbating and worsening a condition, and there are limitations to what that puffer can do.
Right. No, I do understand. Right. Those 2 weeks that it was above 40 there, I was going from the house to the car to the building. That's
it's
going outside.
It's very, very difficult. And unfortunately, it's with this kind of weather, when it's hot and humid like that, there's very little that you can do externally outside of the home where you have control of your environment to really prevent that from occurring, which is why those warnings are out all the time with regards to those hot, humid days.
So there's nothing I can do.
Well, sometimes puffers will work, but inhalers to try and make it easier to breathe. But the problem, though, is that it's more of a Band-Aid solution because mm-hmm. although you may be making yourself easier to breathe with the inhaler, you're still breathing in that hot, humid air that was causing it in the first place. And so it'll have limitations to how effective it is. And sometimes what may happen is you may feel a little bit better And then you stay out even longer because you're feeling a bit better, but then you pay the price afterwards because you're still being exposed over time to that type of air environment.
Okay, let's move on to another call, and we'll go to, is it Jean?
Yes.
Yes, Jean, go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Dworkin. And I have a question. I don't know whether I'm being foolish to go ahead with this. The gastroenterologist found a bacteria called
Oh, yes, Helicobacter pylori.
Yeah, and he said I've probably had it since childhood, and it's usually a third world country problem.
Not really. No, this is extremely common to see this bacteria.
Oh, I've never heard of it. My problem is the seniors cover 1 week of the pack.
Right.
And the second week, I have to pay $200 to get the two-week pack.
Yeah,
I'm 73 and at the end of the line, I don't know if it's worth it.
Actually, there is a way around this. And just for our listeners, Helicobacter pylori is responsible for about 90% of all gastric ulcers. It was discovered by Dr. Barry Marshall, who is an Australian who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for doing this. In fact, he proved it when everybody said that it wasn't the cause by actually drinking and consuming the bacteria to prove that it gave you an ulcer.
He gave himself an ulcer.
He gave himself
to win
an
a
ulcer.
Nobel Prize.
Yeah, yeah. Good trade-off, by the way. But the treatment is, as you mentioned, it's called a triple therapy. There are two antibiotics that are used.
Yes.
Usually amoxicillin and clarithromycin are the two antibiotics that are used.
And then
there's a medication to prevent the acid secretion. And they're given as a triple therapy. Sometimes in a pack called HP pack.
That's right.
Right. But although it's covered for the first week, this is what you can do, Gene. You can ask your doctor to prescribe each of those medications separately, and they will be covered for you because it's the pack itself that they only cover for a week.
Yeah.
But amoxicillin is covered for whatever time you need to use it for. Clarithromycin is covered for an extra week. And the Pantelock or whichever other medication is used to treat the acid is also covered. So your doctor can prescribe each one of those medications individually for that last week, and then you won't have to spend the $200.
Oh, so how do we get around that? Do I have to take it consecutive for 2 weeks, or does he just resubscribe another?
Yeah, what he would do, what your physician would do is give you that pack for the first week,
yeah.
But at the same time, he would be giving you another prescription to fill at the same time to hold on to, so you just continue taking the same dosing type that you've done before for that extra week, except it's not in a special package. It's in separate bottles.
Oh, so I have to go to his office and get a new prescription.
Or you can call his office and say, could you prescribe those medications separately so that it will be covered for me?
Oh, for the second week.
Exactly.
Oh, you're a hero. That's $200.
Yeah, it saves you $200, but it's completely legal. It's not fraudulent at all. You're prescribing the medications for a medical condition, except this way you're prescribing each one individually, and it's covered, as opposed to trying to prescribe it in that special package where they have that limitation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, Gene.
Hey, I have one more question. Do you have time?
Very quickly, yes.
My son has a peculiar body odor. And he has good hygiene. Do you
right.
have the answer to why?
Well, usually odor is a result of bacteria that break down various proteins on the surface of the skin, or sugars on the surface of the skin. I mean, that would be something for him to either see a dermatologist about. Sometimes it's an endocrine or hormonal problem that does that. You know, that's something for him to discuss with his physician, but it's very difficult for me to answer that question for you.
Who does he need to see? What kind of a doctor?
I probably would see his family doctor first, who can take a good history, because, you know, if your son is washing and using soap all the time and still having that problem, there's probably people that family doctor can send to be able to figure that out for him.
We have no family doctor.
Uh-huh.
This is our problem. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Gene, you're welcome.
Good luck. It's the most entertaining call we've had in months, I think. Larry.
Yes.
Tough act to follow, Larry.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
Okay. My question, doctor, is on osteoporosis and this new drug from Amgen that's just recently been approved by FDA.
Yes.
And I guess a little bit of background. My wife has osteoporosis,
mm-hmm.
and she started with Evista, but the side effects were too much, so
mm-hmm.
she went on Actinel.
Mm-hmm.
On that for 4 years, and then they prescribed a Clasta injection.
Right.
So she did that 1 year, and then we spent some time looking up the whole bisphosphonate issue and some of the problems with like the whole bisphosphonate concept of stopping the osteoclast instead of either boosting osteoblasts or doing, you know, something else,
right,
started to worry us. So she's now back on Actonel because the clast is such a phenomenally toxic product. So my question then is, do you have an opinion on this new thing? Because it's also, even though it's new and it's different, it still just stops the osteoclast from starting the regeneration project.
Yeah, this is actually a monoclonal antibody treatment that blocks a protein that signals to the osteoclasts to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so it blocks those proteins, thereby essentially stopping the osteoclast from absorbing bone. That's how that works. You get decreased bone resorption and increased bone density. So it reduces the formation, the function, and survival of the osteoclasts. Osteoblasts are the reverse. Osteoblasts are the cells that you want for bone because it produces bone growth. And in fact, when you looked at some of these studies, the studies showed that it's quite a remarkable improvement in bone density when you use this. It's actually a very elegant way to treat osteoporosis and bone demineralization because it simply treats one factor. It blocks that one protein and leaves everything else alone. So it's not touching the osteoclasts at all. It's not touching anything else. It's simply binding to the messenger. It's simply the body is sending a message to the osteoclasts to work. So that messenger is intercepted, and that's all that happens with it. So it's actually quite an elegant medication in terms of, for potential for side effects being reduced, and also the fact that it really helps bone improve over time. So it's likely to be used more and more as it comes to market. I mean, I believe it is on market in Canada now. It has been approved. Not much prescriptions done yet for it. I believe it is something that is injected, and so it has to be used that way.
Yeah, but twice a year is the the current standard, I guess.
Right.
The question I have, though, is while it does it differently, it still stops the osteoclast. How does the osteoblast do its job if it doesn't have the trigger from the osteoclast to say, I've made a space, now you can fill in?
No, the osteoblasts still work, but the problem is the osteoclasts are more active. So when you reduce the osteoclast function, right, you're going to have bone that ends up being, you're shifting the balance, as it were, with regards to bone formation. The osteoblasts don't completely shut off. They do slow down, but if you stop the resorption, you give a chance for that bone to regrow. So in terms of its effect, the studies that they have done showed quite a significant improvement in bone density when you use the medication. So it's just another option. I think it's a nice option for people if other methods have not worked.
We have to be very, very fast with our final caller of the day, Lloyd. Hello, Lloyd.
Hello.
Hi, Lloyd. Go ahead very, very quickly, please.
Yeah, it's a simple question. When I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, my friends had allergies, you know, from plants, asthma, that sort of thing. Now I'm seeing this peanut allergy. What has caused that? That seems to be something new to me.
Well, that's
we grew up in peanut butter, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the million-dollar question. And then there are several hypotheses. One of them is called the hygiene hypothesis, where we have eliminated a lot of the allergens out there that we normally would be exposed to, keeping everything so clean that our bodies don't learn how to recognize what's normal and what isn't normal. And there has been some evidence to demonstrate that that is one of the factors. But as to why peanut allergies itself are increasing, that's the million-dollar question. If they were able to answer that, I think would go a long way to preventing it. But
and we'd probably make $1 million.
You'd probably make a lot more than that. So unfortunately, there's no quick answer to that. Hygiene hypothesis is one of the reasons, but no one knows for sure right now why we're seeing more of it at this time.
Great to see you this week.
Good
Thanks for answering all those questions.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Barry Dworkin will be back with the Sunday House Call Sunday at 4. And don't forget health headlines at 10 to 7 during Madeley in the Morning on 580 CFRA.